I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. This is the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm Howard Jacobson of plantyourself.com, the Big Change Program, and WellStart Health. This podcast is part of my mission to help you live a long and luscious life. Today's guest, Walter Longo, is my bet to become the first Nobel Prize winner who has appeared on the Plant Yourself podcast. He's a longevity researcher at the University of Southern California, whose broad vision and ability to focus on the details of scientific inquiry over a 30-year career so far may provide the data we need to extend the human lifespan by decades. And not through CRISPR or nanotechnology or Himalayan yak butter in our coffee, but through like really simple lifestyle and diet protocols readily available to many of us, like plant-based food and moderate physical activity. And fasting. Well, not fasting exactly, but a protocol that Longo and his team have developed that mimics the mind-blowingly positive effects of fasting without the actual caloric deprivation. His book, The Longevity Diet, goes into the science and practical how-tos of what he calls the fasting mimicking diet. And he graciously accepted an invitation to share his insights with me on this podcast. Before we get to it, a couple of notes for my whole food plant-based friends. First, Dr. Longo believes that some wild-caught fish, you know, salmon, sardines, certain kinds, is a good addition to the diet. And he's quite fond of olive oil and in quantities that would make, you know, Caldwell Esselstyn gasp. And I ask about his views on these topics. We talk about him a little bit in the podcast and about the supporting evidence that he sees. And I allowed myself to be satisfied with his responses. You know, I'm not much of a debater. I leave that to, Garth Davis and D. Colin Campbell, my co-authors, both of whom have a much broader and deeper grasp of the science than I do. And of course, I'm so thrilled that Walter Longo appears on the podcast, one of the most respected researchers in the world of health and longevity. And I'm so thrilled that he's promoting a plant-based diet, plus a couple of servings of fish per week, as the world's healthiest, that I really wanted to focus on the good news rather than the areas where our recommendations diverge. That said, I don't agree that olive oil is a health food. It's a lot less bad than other saturated fats and oils, but its health benefits have been shown only in studies that replace those fats and oils with olive oil. So I don't believe we have clinical trials or population-based evidence that can tell us anything about consuming olive oil versus having no processed oils or saturated fats at all. And the lab data, such as brachial challenges and the common sense model of caloric density and satiety, such as that promoted by Chef AJ, still compelled me to strongly discourage olive oil consumption among those humans wishing to live a long time. But who knows? Walter Longo's a smart guy. And it's also not entirely clear to me which of his recommendations are based on the objective science and which are also influenced by his perception of adoptability. Clearly, his fasting mimicking diet, which fully acknowledges the value of water-only fasting, is seen as preferable since most people will not willingly endure the discomfort of fasting or may be so medically compromised that they can't do it or they can't do it on their own. So the fasting mimicking diet may not be superior to fasting, but, you know, the next best thing. And it's possible that adding fish and olive oil to a whole food plant-based diet may similarly be an accommodation in which the two least harmful products in their class, animal food and processed oil respectively, are added to a diet Longo perceives as, you know, too restrictive to achieve mass adoption. And he may be right. Anyway, I thought long and hard about how to raise these issues in the conversation. I'm not convinced I did a great job, so I would love your feedback on that. Before we get to it, one quick item of business, which is the next big change slash well start cohort starts soon. We're looking at a May 14th soft launch. That's this coming Monday. And, you know, giving you a week to sort of get on board and get oriented. And then the program itself starting the following Monday, May 21st. So if you're interested, go to wellstarthealth.com/program, read about it, and then at the bottom there's a button to apply. All right, with all that, it's time to talk to Walter Longo. I'm so excited to share this with you. So without further ado, Dr. Walter Longo, welcome to the Plant Yourself podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So you wrote an amazing book that I've just finished and I'm reading for the second time, The Longevity Diet. I guess it came out in Italian first and now in English?
Yes. It's been out in the U.S. Since early January now.
Great. So I guess I'd love to begin with your story, which is such a beautiful and interesting story about, you know, the luck of the draw, and where you grew up and what brought you to the United States and led you to longevity research.
Yeah, so obviously I had no idea at the time, but that my parents, a little town of a couple thousand people, will end up being one of the ones with the highest, among the ones with the highest prevalence portion of centenarians in the world. And then my region where I grew up in Liguria, in the northwest of Italy, turns out to be Genova, my city, actually turns out to be the city in Europe with the highest over 65 population. Now it's at 28.2%. And also it turns out to be one of the few places around the world to historically have a pescatarian diet, which eventually science would suggest being probably the healthiest one that you can adapt. So, yeah, so interesting origin when it's related to longevity and nutrition.
Mm-hmm. And you know, there's lots of, like, you know, studies of the different blue zones, but most of that information came from, like, post-World War II in the 1940s, and we know that people in Okinawa eat very differently now. So when you were growing up, I guess you and I are roughly the same age. I guess you were born in the sort of mid to late 60s.
Yes.
Right, so when you were growing up in the early 70s, early 80s, were you still eating a more or less traditional diet and living more or less a traditional lifestyle in terms of movement and community?
Yes, absolutely. So when we went south for, let's say, 3 months a year, we would very frequently, maybe five times a week, have these green beans and vegetables plus some pasta dish, which is in the book, and it's called pasta and vianella. And in northern Italy, where I spent the other 9 months a year in Liguria, we will have maybe fish once a week, and you know, probably have meat once a week, and chicken once a week. That was probably the typical week at the table. Of course, there was probably times where we will have meat or fish more days of the week, but certainly it was very different than it is now. Yeah.
Right, and so you came to America to study guitar, right?
Yes, I came to the U.S. To study jazz guitar, although I was really training to be a rock musician. So that's what I wanted to do. But jazz at the time was the best thing you could study to train in electric guitar performance.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I guess ultimately you're going to have to study Keith Richards to understand longevity, right?
Well, yeah, I didn't study Keith Richards that much, but certainly I was very interested in Jimi Hendrix and Mark Knopfler of Dire Straits and the Pink Floyd, David Gilmour. So those were the guitar players that I was trying to imitate, and then of course. Music school, of course, it was interesting, but I think it played a tremendous role also in the scientific approach that I've always had. So I think I would definitely recommend music school to scientists. I think it's a great way to start instead of the idea of just think differently. And think ahead and try to do things that that you haven't heard before, and that's something that you get used to whether you do composition but also performance. That is the type of training you get.
Yeah, and you wrote, I thought, very beautifully that music kind of predisposed you when you started doing science to look for evidence that's, quote, in tune with evolution. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
Yes. So I mean that we're really the result of billions of years of evolution. And I think in most cases, whether in medicine or in science, we forget those 3 billion years. And we always try to come up with things that are really based on the last 100 years. And that's a mistake. And that's a mistake because eventually you're going to do, in most cases, more bad than good. Why? Well, because you're not really understanding these 3 billion years. And so, for example, if you block cholesterol synthesis, you may think that you're doing something very good. But that's not really in tune with evolution, right? You're just blocking something. The body's trying to make something, and it doesn't do it by mistake. It may be fooled by a series of conditions, but it's trying to make cholesterol. And so to fix the problem, you have to figure out why is it making so much cholesterol, and what is it trying to do with it. And so eventually you can really get rid of the problem at its source. And I think the best way to do that is to do something that is in tune with evolution.
Right, because like what you're talking about really is seeing the body as something with its own intelligence, as opposed to, I think, the way most medical and scientific research has looked at the body, which is just to understand just what's going on at a smaller and smaller level, and then which lever can we push to manipulate it.
Yeah, so this view of the body that is not able to handle a lot of its own problems is really prehistoric, and it doesn't mean the body knows how to handle all of its problems. Of course, in some cases you need surgery, in some cases you need drugs. In some cases, you need combination of drugs and the induction of self-repair. But you always want to start with how does the body, whether it's an autoimmunity or cancer or is a neurodegenerative condition, you always want to start with, or cardiovascular, how can the body deal with this? I always say, if you cut yourself, anything exterior that happens to you, any wound, is repaired to almost perfection in the great majority of cases, right? And I think it's naive to think that after 3 billion years, we evolved all these systems to fix the skin and everything on the outside, but we have not evolved anything to fix problems on the inside. So it's obvious that we have. I mean, we've done many papers showing that. And so we need to start with that. Exploit the body's ability and push the body to fix itself. And sometimes it's going to need a hand. For example, chemotherapy plus fasting-mimicking diet in cancer treatment, obviously it's working better than the fasting alone. It means that once the cancer is metastatic, it's advanced, the body may not be able to, or doesn't seem to be able to do anything anymore. So at that point, then the drug becomes very useful. And the combination seems to work best.
So when you talk about like programmed longevity and programmed aging, can you explain what that means and what's the meaning for sort of your way of thinking about aging and staying young versus some older ways?
Yeah, so I think that the community is really focused on the process of things going progressively wrong. And that's what's called aging or senescence. And I never liked this idea. You know, this is why in the book I talk about juventology or juventology versus gerontology. So the study of youth. And why is that a big difference? Because if you look at a mouse, it lives for 2.5 years, and for 1.5 years, it's very healthy, right? So and people, we live for 80 years and we're very healthy for 40 to 50 years. And so I'm very interested in the program that makes sure that for these 50 years in people or for 1.5 years in the mouse makes everything almost perfect. And rarely you develop any disease. And that's what I call the program longevity. What is the longevity program that keeps everything so perfect? And what happens to that program after? And can we keep it on for longer or much longer so that you live to, instead of 80, maybe you live to 100, but you live very healthy to 100? And of course, this used to be science fiction, and now it's a reality. You know, I'm about to go down to Ecuador in 10 days, and in Ecuador, we've shown already in these subjects that have the same mutation that make mice have a record longevity, and this is in the growth hormone receptor. We've shown that they are protected from cancer, from diabetes, and from age-dependent cognitive decline. And now we're going down to look at their cardiovascular profile. So this idea of programmed longevity is now clearly can be showed or is present in both mice and humans. Now we have to find ways, and that's where the fasting and fasting mimicking diet come in. We have to find ways to be able to do it without necessarily pharmacological interventions. Eventually even pharmacological intervention, I assume. But I mean, I think for now, the dietary interventions are best. And programmed aging instead is something much more, for the specialists. I think it has to do with, is it possible that we are actually programmed to die? Wallace and Darwin had both speculated that that this would be possible, that the force of natural selection. So there is a force to not only keep us healthy until we're 50, there is another force to kill us after that to get us out of the way. Now, that's much more controversial. We published several papers 15 years ago about this, at least in microorganisms, showing that some organisms are, in fact, can be, in fact, programmed to die and get out of the way to let the younger thrive. This is much more difficult to study in humans. But I just put it in the book because I thought it's interesting for people to think about that. And that's why I have it in there. But I really much more focused on the longevity program. So on this youthfulness program.
Yeah, and you know, reading it, it struck me as both sort of very like plausible. I don't want to say obvious, but certainly plausible that there's a longevity program. And I was struck by the fact that I had never considered it before. And I think it's partly because the model I was using, my mental model, was sort of like a car. Like there, you know, we don't think if we buy a new car that it has some magical or intentional protection until it reaches 130,000 miles. But my experience of a car is that it works great until it all starts falling apart. And I kind of thought about the human body in the same way, that there was nothing that the car was doing to protect itself in those early years.
Sure. And this is why in the book I talk about the car plus the body shop plus the mechanic, right? So the car itself doesn't have that, but the car experience, if you want to call it, does, right? So you have the dealership that tells you bring it in. You have the mechanics that can take care of problems when they arise. So, yeah, there is a system to do the same even for the car. It's just not intrinsic in the car itself, but in what surrounds the car. So it makes sense as the body will have done all of that by itself, and as the mechanic and the body shop all inside, so that that you really, in most cases, don't need to take it anywhere. I mean, of course, evolution has to take care of this because it cannot predict that we're going to have doctors, and you know, and for most of our evolution is Homo sapiens, but also before us, there were no doctors, and so the body had to take care of its own problems, and that's why you want to have this this longevity program to make sure that everything is renewed and fixed. And also to make sure that some of the damaged cells are eliminated.
So you have a photograph in the book of a young couple of childbearing age and with a baby. And I took that as kind of, it's like a riddle, right? Like I had never thought of it before, that basically the baby is a set of new, totally, you know, working cells from this couple that might be in their 30s or 40s. What's the significance of seeing having a baby in that way, and what are the implications?
Well, the significance is really about showing that the body is able to distinguish young from old and select only young and select only nearly perfect, so that a nearly perfect organism is generated. So the significance is really about the body ability to reset everything to zero. Now, it doesn't do it for itself, but it certainly knows how to do that. And in a very sophisticated way, with high performance, meaning that most babies are nearly perfect. And so, yeah, there was the point that to show that all the systems that are able to rejuvenate are already there. They're just only applied to the birth of a offspring, and not to our own cells, but certainly there must be, at least to a certain level, there is, not there must be, now we've shown that there is, or there are systems that can get rid of damage and replace the damage with new and young, both inside of a cell and inside of an organ.
So to some extent, is the longevity project to sort of fool the genes into thinking that they're producing offspring when they're just rejuvenating ourselves?
No, I don't think so. I think the longevity program really is about something. So imagine that you started a car company and you make the decision, I want to have this car on the road for 100,000 miles. In the beginning, you could just build a nice car. But then eventually you will find out very rapidly that that's not enough, right? That you got to have a body shop, that you got to have a mechanic, that you got to have somebody that replaces the tires, et cetera, et cetera. So that is what the longevity program is behaving based on the force of natural selection to, each year, starting with bacteria 3 billion years ago, and moving on, you progressively develop a new, you learn, and then you develop something, let's say a DNA repair enzyme, a protein repair, a immune system, et cetera, et cetera, so that the body stays almost perfect until, say, age 50, at which point, at least historically, you will have had grandchildren, and then it's okay if you get out of the way.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. You talk about the five pillars, and the fifth pillar is the study of complex systems. So it's like we think of a car as an inanimate object, but a car within an intelligent ecosystem of maintenance is something else. And so saying that the human organism or any organism is itself a complex system that is designed to accomplish particular goals.
Yeah, so the human body is equipped with its own body shop, its own mechanic, its own repair and replacement system, the tire shop, right? So all of it is there, not for everything. For example, there is some repair and replacement in bones, but not that much. So some things are just built once and they stay there. But so they are for the car, right? The body of the car probably never gets replaced. Maybe it gets fixed, but not necessarily replaced. So I think that we're similar in that sense. Some things that are important to be replaced, for example, the liver keeps generating new cells. But the brain has some new generations of cells, but not that much. And at least of neurons. I mean, as generation of other cell types, but not neurons, or very little. So that's probably what's occurring.
Right. And so, the way classical evolution is believed to work is that survival of the next generations then cements whatever mutation or changes or developments have occurred. So if we're saying that we're decoupling longevity from the evolutionary manifest, then we have to work against the body, but sort of work orthogonally to what the body is trying to is naturally trying to do within a species, right?
Well, yeah, we're not decoupling. We are, the two things are very much combined and connected. At a certain point, I mean, what we've been trying to do is to is to utilize what's always been around to change that program, to extend that program, right? And so, for example, we've known that if you look at somebody who's anorexic, they're not going to be able to have children. And why is that? Well, that makes perfect sense, right, in evolutionary terms, because if you're anorexic and you have very little food, or, you know, let's say 30,000 years ago, you had very little food, you'd be in an anorexic state, it makes no sense for the system to allow you to reproduce, right? Because you're going to die and the child is going to die. Mm-hmm. So it's a futile investment. So then what did evolution do? Well, it selected for a reduction in the aging process during that starvation period. And also an investment in protective systems and probably in regenerative systems, or at least in standby regeneration. So the body is ready to regenerate. So now if you exploit programs like that or process it like that, now you can potentially say, you know, we only reproduce a few times in our lives. Why do we need to be in a reproduction mode all the time? We don't. I mean, we used to because obviously you will want to take any opportunity possible, you know, 30,000 years ago to reproduce. Now that's not the case, right? So then the argument could be, well, let's keep the body in a starvation response mode without necessarily starving it. We could do this in different ways, and that, you know, we've now shown in many different organisms that these can now put the body in a standby mode, so extend the longevity program. And then, of course, if you need to reproduce, you can come out of it and go back into it. So that's the idea. Now, you know, it's not as simple as I'm making it sound, but you know, we're already doing it, and we already have already shown the effects, and it's just a matter of now getting better and better at it, always keeping in mind the being in tune with evolution.
That's really fascinating to think about. You know, basically put, like, it sounds like evolution has prepared us to just walk around ready for sex all the time, and that implies a certain amount of energy expenditure that we no longer need to make, and that we can intelligently funnel into these protective systems and elongative systems.
Yes. Now, of course, ready for sex is a tricky one, because obviously people wouldn't want to stay in a non-ready for sex mode. But more than ready for sex, I would say ready for reproduction mode. You know, so it's a better way to look at it, because it looks like they can be uncoupled. You know, that you can be ready for sex, but not necessarily ready for reproduction.
So I know you studied with Roy Walford, who became famous for spending a year and a half or 2 years in Biosphere 2, and there, you wrote something in the book that has puzzled me for a while, which is that, you know, being on a calorically restricted diet is one of the only proven ways to extend life in just about any organism, and yet it may have contributed to Walford's premature death. Can you explain the paradox of the people in Biosphere, both, you know, doing something to extend their lives, but also like harming their health, you know, being sort of miserable and coming out looking not so good?
Yes, I think with any powerful intervention, you can have something very positive or something very negative coming out of it, right? And so calorie restriction obviously was triggering or beginning to trigger something very powerful. And so if you look at their blood, when the Walford and the others were in Biosphere 2, I mean, there was drastic changes in reduction in cholesterol, triglyceride, fasting glucose, blood pressure, So if a cardiologist looked at them, and even an oncologist, they would say, or certainly an endocrinologist, they would say, these people are never going to get diabetes. They're never going to have heart, at least heart disease based on you know, accumulation of cholesterol, et cetera, atheromas. And they're probably going to have a very reduced incidence of cancer. And this eventually was confirmed by the studies of somebody else that was in Wolfram's lab before me. His name is Richard Weindruck at the University of Wisconsin with the monkeys, right? So that's exactly what they've shown. But yet, when they restricted the monkeys for 25 years, they had, you know, great reduction in cancer, cardiovascular disease, no diabetes, but then they died just a little bit later than the monkeys on the regular diet, right? And the regular diet was not that good of a diet. It was close to a Western diet. So that's it. You know, that tells you that this is being pushed to the limit is okay for a while. But if you do it for a long time, you're going to get the good and the bad, and they cancel each other out. And, you know, it's not surprising that this idea that you could just beat the longevity, the existing longevity program by just starving, by just, you know, continuously restricting somebody in a severe way. I think there was a wishful thinking and maybe a naive idea, right? Even mice, if you look at mice, the original data seemed to be very positive, but then when people looked at all kinds of different genetic backgrounds, some genetic background did worse on calorie restriction, right? So, yeah, so then what Walford and others missed at the time were the molecular biology and the genetics of aging, which we were lucky enough to you know, be able to take advantage of. Of course, it took a lot of work because we're the ones that they came up with the genes that, I mean, me and a group of others around the United States, and mostly. Yeah, so we're the ones that discovered these genes like Taurus, kinase, IGF-1, PKA, et cetera, that are so central to the aging process. But that was really necessary to understand how to do the good of calorie restriction without the bad that may have very well contributed to Walford's Lou Gehrig's disease, although we don't know. I mean, that's speculation.
Right. But, you know, when you talk about being in tune with evolution and sort of, you know, in tune with how the human organism evolved, you know, I would think that it would be common to have periods of starvation or near starvation and, you know, and periods of gluttony, that there, you know, something about the ability to withstand lots of different, you know, caloric experiences might be something that would sort of, you know, bolster the system, provide positive stressor the same way that, like, lifting weights both breaks down and strengthens muscles. Is that partly the impetus behind the idea of intermittent fasting?
Yes. I mean, there's no doubt that people starve all the time, meaning that it was very frequent for humans and all kinds of organisms. I mean, microorganisms spend most of their time starving. But even humans, it's pretty clear if you look at history that, you know, it was almost impossible to avoid doing relatively long periods of fasting and starvation frequently. That said, we really need to move away, I think, from using what people used to do to think that what people used to do is necessarily good, right? So, and that's what the why in the book I talk about five pillars, because it has to be a match. It has to be a common denominator between what people used to do and what the science and the epidemiological data and the clinical work, et cetera, now shows to be good for you, right? So, you know, like, for example, you hear about the paleo diet. Well, the argument that just because people did it, it's good for you, it's not a bad argument. Now, at the same time, it's also a bad idea to say, I have tested a drug or an intervention. Nobody's ever done that before, but I'm sure it's going to work in the long run, right? So I think what you really need is to have both. And so let's say that you're talking about a high animal protein, high animal fat diet, one version of the paleo diet. Well, you could say, okay, fine, people used to do that. There was a period where we may have done that, or we probably did that. Well, let's look at the science and the clinical data and the epidemiological studies and the centenarian studies, and none of them support it, right? None of them. If you look at epidemiological data, people that do that live shorter. If you look at animal data, animals put on that diet live shorter. If you look at the centenarians, none of the record longevity groups had that, right? So it's the same thing with fasting and fasting periods. You have to match it with the science, and luckily for fasting, the science is very positive. You know, many of the old people with record longevity did fasting, and the mouse data is very positive. It shows lifespan extension, protection, and epidemiologically, there is some negative data for certain type of fasting. For example, there is negative data for daily, you know, say 16-hour fasting. There's negative data both for gallstone formation, and there is negative data for people that skip breakfast over and over and over. Now the epidemiological studies are suggesting, and you know, if you're fasting for 16 hours, you're probably going to skip breakfast. And now a number of studies are showing that people that do that, because they don't have breakfast, live shorter and are more prone to cardiovascular disease and cancer. So, you know, what is the reason for it? We don't know. Is it about skipping breakfast, or is it something else that people that skip breakfast do? We don't know, but certainly it's a bad start. Right? So this is to address the fact that people want simple answers, and you just can't do that. Whether it's calorie restriction or fasting or the paleo diet, you know, people would love to say, we used to do that, therefore, that's what I'm going to do that. That's what I'm going to do, and I'm going to live longer. It doesn't work like that. And as we've shown a few years ago, there is also phases of life, you know. So you're going to have a diet. You probably need to have a certain diet up to age 20, another diet at least from 20 to 65, and probably there's a couple of diets there, and another diet from 65 to 80, 90, and another diet from 90 to 110, if you ever make it there. And that's more complex than people want to do or want to understand, but that's what's emerging from all these pillars, and that's what I talk about in the book. And it's not that hard to understand it. I mean, you know, if supposedly you can go for 40 years on a diet, that's okay, you know, to learn it, have to learn how to do it twice, you know.
So I love the talk of the pillars, this sort of, you know, preponderance of evidence, as opposed to look like, you know, people who are trying to make money with something will very often point to a single study that, you know, short term of questionable funding manipulates the data to get the result they want. And you're looking at a very, very broad picture. So can you talk about what the five pillars tell us about what's the ideal human diet, you know, at whatever level of generality or specificity you think would be helpful?
Yeah, so I always thought it was strange that, you know, in a courtroom, if somebody's accused of murder, you will have all these different pieces of evidence, you know, that go into deciding whether somebody's guilty or not, you know, and they go from DNA evidence to what is the motive, were you there at the time, can we prove that you were there, on and on and on, you know. And then when we get to nutrition or many different problems in medicine, oftentimes we just go with one piece of evidence, right? And you know, that in the courtroom, that would be laughable, you know, that they would never even consider something like that. So I always thought it was strange how science cannot even do what we do in the courtroom. And so the five pillars really is trying to address it from that, beyond a reasonable doubt, you know. is it possible to say, well, you know, I can never be sure, but this is about as solid as it gets. And we're going to go this way. We're going to convict this person or convict this diet, you know. And so the pillars, you know, the first one is epidemiological studies. So in the book, I talk about a pescatarian diet. And if you look at the epidemiological studies, so the studies of, you know, thousands or sometimes hundreds of thousands and sometimes millions of people, you have very little negative data for a pescatarian diet, meaning that over and over and over, the studies are supporting a vegan vegetable plus fish diet as being very, very healthy for you, particularly, you know, if you avoid, let's say, high mercury fish and maybe some of the vegetables that they may be associated with inflammation and certain problems. And the epidemiological studies are supporting a low protein but sufficient protein diet. So that's also very important, right? And our study then showed that after age 65, you probably have to increase the level of proteins because the body is not able to, and you might have to also increase the variety of foods that you eat because the body might not be as good as it used to be in processing and incorporating processing food and generating amino acids and basic components that are then going to be part of the biosynthetic process. So that's pillar one. Pillar two is clinical studies. Right? So what happens if you the gold standard is you do a randomized clinical study. So there's not as much data as there is epidemiological data in randomized clinical studies. But certainly, if you look, for example, at the study done in Spain, and in the book I talk about 60-30-10, 60% carbohydrates, mostly from legumes and vegetables, 30% fats, mostly from olive oil, nuts, and fatty fish, and 10% protein. Now, if you look at large randomized studies done in Spain on people that were at risk for cardiovascular disease, and if they were randomized to a group that had high olive oil, high nut content in the diet, or both, compared to a low-fat group, meaning a group that was exposed to a low-fat diet, they did so much better if they were on the high olive oil nut diet that they had to stop the study because it was unethical for the controls. There is also lots of support in one way or another from the clinical studies for this pescatarian diet. And also, you know, for the fasting mimicking diet, you know, I talk about periodic fasting mimicking diet. And we've done our own clinical studies. And others are now carrying out studies on different forms of fast. But certainly for the periodic fasting mimicking diet, we've shown very clear effects of 5-day fasting period in randomized clinical studies. Then you have basic research. That's the third pillar. What happens if you feed mice a low-protein diet, for example, they do much better. What if you feed mice a high saturated fat diet? They die early. So lots of the things that certainly the selection of the pescatarian diet is very much low-protein pescatarian diet is very much supported by the mouse studies. So the basic research is also supportive. And then you have centenarian studies. So what about people that have record longevity? And whether it's Okinawa, Calabria, Italy, Sardinia, Italy, Icaria in Greece, or certain regions of Costa Rica or Loma Linda, California, all these areas pretty much have a vegan plus fish and plus some meat diet, but not very much. You know, the meat is once a week type of event. for most of these populations. And so that's pillar number four. It's very important, right? Because you don't want to come up with something that, again, scientifically looks great, and then 30 years down the road, it starts killing people. It's very possible. It wouldn't be the first time we come up with something that looks great at the beginning, and then it turns out to be a nightmare. And the fifth pillar is complex systems, as we were discussing earlier. What about cars and planes? And you know, because we build them, we understand them very well, so it's also easy to see how they did deteriorate. So, for example, I talk about you know, should you run 150 minutes a week, 300 minutes a week, or 500 minutes a week. Well, you know, if you look at the data, the epidemiological data, it looks like 150 is about as good as 300 minutes. And then you start thinking of a car and say, well, you know, if you drive a car all the time, the tires are and everything else is going to wear out, right? So, you know, assuming that the body is better than a car and can fix itself, but eventually it's going to get worse and worse at fixing itself. So, Is it a good idea to run 500 minutes a week when 150 from the epidemiological data is already suggesting a near maximization of the effects? Probably not. Yeah, stick with 150. If you really like it, go to 300 minutes, and that's good. You know, that's a good level. So yeah, that's how the five pillars can help shape these recommendations.
Yeah. So I had a question about that and the data. You know, just around the complexity of it. So if like I was thinking, so, you know, and I'm biased because I'm a runner, and so I'm closer to, you know, 300, 400, 500 minutes a week than 150. And I feel like because I eat a plant-based diet that's very low inflammatory, I recover faster, I can run more. So is the data on 150 minutes for people who are eating like me or people who are eating a sort of the standard Western diet, or is it, you know, comprehensive?
It's comprehensive. This is for everybody, right? So they went out and looked at everybody that runs and everybody that doesn't run, and then they just compare them. And the runners, or not runners, but the people that did exercise for 150 minutes, I think there was a 37% reduction in overall mortality, and, you know, and also this has been done for different diseases. And so that's great. Then if you went to 300 minutes, I think it went to from 37 to 43%. I have the numbers in the book. So it wasn't a big difference. And then, of course, as you go more than 300 minutes, which would mean, you know, an hour a day for 5 days a week, you get into, you know, a poorly understood territory. There's a lot less people that do that. And it doesn't mean that somebody couldn't do very well with it. It just means that it's not a good recommendation for everybody. Then you know, people may be able to do extremely well doing that, you know. And also because, you know, some people understand, for example, if you hurt yourself, you got to stop. You have to be back in an optimal or in a ready to run again condition, right? And some people may do that, and some people may not. So I think the recommendation to the masses should be stick with 150 to 300 minutes. And then if somebody is an athlete and they really you know, want to do more than that, then you know, there is some risk involved, but that's something that they have to consider, like in your case, you know.
And to be clear, you're also recommending that people walk an hour a day that doesn't count towards that 150 or 300 minutes, right?
Yeah, I recommend they walk at least an hour a day, and at least a couple hours on the weekend. So then you know that people do everything, you know, in the traditional way. So go up the stairs, you know, and everything, try to do it yourself, you know. And so I think that certainly makes the adds maybe a couple of hours a day, ideally, to the exercise in you know, moving, walking, and going up the stairs, etc.
Gotcha. So I want to cover the you know, your innovation of the FMD, the fasting mimicking diet, and I was struggling a little bit to understand this. So you have sort of four elements that define a fasting state for the body. And so your goal was to achieve all those four elements while still giving people calories. Was that the quest?
Yes. We wanted to not interfere with the we wanted to be in tune with evolution, so not interfere with the starvation program, but at the same time allow people to eat, and at the same time prevent the intake of ingredients that are otherwise negative. So those are and of course we are also very very focused on safety. Can this be done by almost anybody, or not almost anybody, by the majority of people anywhere? And that was all the considerations that went into the fasting mimicking diet.
So what was that quest like? Did you sort of hit upon the outlines of the correct formula right away? Were there a lot of dead ends?
We have spent decades on connecting nutrients with genes. So, you know, we knew right away that some of the fundamental things that we had to do, but it took years to keep developing it, keep testing it, first in mice and then in people, to eventually have something that not only it gets the effects, and we learned the hard way, it's also about compliance. You could have, you know, everything perfect in your head, in your lab, and even in a clinic if you check somebody in, but then what happens when you get out there? So we also had to have some minor compromises on that I push myself, and then my colleagues may say, well, you know, if you're trying to shut off this gene, why don't you have less of that? And my answer is, because I want people to be able to do it. And if people cannot do it, then it's just, the whole thing is pointless. And, you know, eventually we might have like the perfect version for the hardcore ones, the ones that say, you know, I can do it however you give it to me. But I think for now, the technology, I think, was also there to make sure that people can do it relatively easily, and it's working. I think it's, we're seeing, you know, tens of thousands of people doing it now, so I think we're on the way to making this a certain option for doctors, but also for people that don't need a doctor yet, to handle at least some of the initial problems in age-related dysfunction.
So what are the benefits of doing the FMD protocol? And I guess you recommend that people who need to lose weight should do it once a month, 5 days once a month, and then people who are at a healthy weight once every 6 months. What does somebody get from doing this thing?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I don't want to sell it because I think, as I explained in the book, it's there, you know, for people to improve with, and I know what you meant by selling it, but I mean, I don't want people to misinterpret it, and I don't make a penny out of this. But the company, there's a company out there, and I just thought that it was important to have a product just because to make it safe and to make it to match the clinical results, and to also please the doctors that really would never have embraced it if there wasn't something that was thoroughly tested clinically and after the clinical study. But anyways, the fasting mimicking diet, what it does and what it was designed to do is to push the body into breaking down many different damaged components, and then turn on the repair and replacement systems, including stem cells, but also including intracellular repair modes that then are executed during the refeeding, right? So the fasting mimicking diet really sets the body up, but it is the refeeding that regenerates and rebuilds and fixes problems. So, I mean, it is the combination, essentially, right? But, of course, people are good at doing refeeding, and people are just very bad at doing fasting, and so that's where the fasting mimicking diet operates. And again, because of the way it's designed, it triggers all these different genetic changes that allow these repair, replacement, and regenerative processes. But the compliance in the clinical trial that we did here at USC, we showed that 3 cycles of the fasting mimicking diet reduce cholesterol, blood pressure, fasting glucose, triglyceride, IGF-1, which is a marker, potential risk factor for cancer, C-reactive protein, a marker for systemic inflammation, and a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. And as far as people that should use it, actually, the once a month is for someone who's obese and has at least 2 markers or risk factors that are elevated. So somebody who's obese, has high cholesterol, high blood pressure, that's once a month. Somebody who's overweight, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, that might be once every 2 months. And then it just goes down from there. All the way to, let's say, 35-year-old athlete that has a pescatarian diet and that has everything perfect. All the blood tests are perfect. So that person may want to consider it twice a year and only if they're if they are of normal weight.
Mm-hmm. And how important is the feeding between instances of the diet? Do you see big improvements even if people go back to their horrible Western diets between FMD sessions?
Yeah. So let me qualify this because the people tend to attack me. So of course in the book I talk about the pescatarian super healthy diet in between, and that's the best, right? And then eventually you may get to the point where you only need to do this twice a year because you have a pescatarian diet. The reality is that people don't have a pescatarian diet. And we see the FMD working the best on those that have the worst diet. So if somebody came in with fasting glucose in the clinical trial, the people that had fasting glucose of 75 or 80, which is excellent, we saw no difference. I mean, it didn't come down anymore. Differently from chronic calorie restriction, you know, if you look at the Wolfer studies, people that had 80 fasting glucose or had a low blood pressure, they came down more, right? And that's probably the distinction between the periodic fasting mimicking diet, at least one of them, and chronic calorie restriction. Chronic calorie restriction is pushing your body to go more and more and more extreme, whether it's good or bad for you. The fasting mimicking diet seems to be doing what probably has always been there to do, at least what fasting has been there to do, but in a safe way, which is get rid of problems and then return to normal with a new set of cells or certainly with some level of rejuvenation. So I use the analogy in the book of a wood-burning train, and I basically say, you know, if you had a wood-burning train, that an old wood burning train and it doesn't have enough fuel to make it to the next station, the engineer will go back and try to grab first the chairs and the walls that are damaged, right? And start burning those for fuel. Now the train becomes lighter and you have enough fuel to make it to the next station. And when you get to the next station, now you rebuild the chairs, you rebuild the walls that you've used in the to obtain fuel. So now you may have 20% of the train is brand new, and you made it to the station, right? And that's exactly what the body does. Um, so, So now if you start with your cells working properly, you're not really fixing anything much, and you don't see a difference. And that's, of course, very, say, in the United States, maybe 10% of the people would be in that category, considering that 72% of Americans are either overweight or obese. And but yeah, if you start with a problem, then the fasting mimicking diet seems to have a very powerful effects in fixing many of these problems, and we suspect that as we've seen in mice, the reason for this is what we've seen in mice, which is multi-system regeneration. For example, in mice we could destroy completely or certainly destroy all the insulin-producing beta cells. In the pancreas of a mouse, and then we start the fasting mimicking diet, and we can show that within 5 cycles or so, the fasting mimicking diet, they're starting making normal levels of insulin again, and this is a permanent effect, meaning that we can stop the diet, and they still now these insulin-producing beta cells are now functional long term. And the mouse now is back to normal.
So you're talking about in mice the equivalent of reversing type 1 diabetes.
Yes. Well, yeah, not the equivalent. We reverse type 1 diabetes in the mouse model and type 2. You know, so it's very effective in mice. You know, now we're going to do clinical trials, of course, to see whether some of this is conserved in humans. But certainly the idea of taking bad cells and replacing them with good cells is clearly there also in humans. The question is, how far can it go? You know, can it like we've seen for people, can it regenerate insulin-producing beta cells and, you know, and neurons and liver cells, et cetera, et cetera? And if so, to what level? And so, of course, the clinical trial that we published suggests that some of that is going on for sure, but the pathology treatments we're just starting to do. Well, some of them we've been doing for years, but we're just starting to learn about how effective they can be.
Gotcha. So I've taken up an hour of your time, so I want to be conscious of not overstepping, but I do want to ask one more thing, because a lot of the audience for this podcast are vegans or whole food plant-based eaters, so they will have been surprised so far to hear that fish and, you know, a fairly copious quantity of olive oil is recommended for longevity. Now, when I look at, say, the PREDIMED study from Spain, I interpret it fairly differently from what I read in the book and from what you've discussed here, which I don't see any of those diets as being equivalent to, say, Esselstyn's or Ornish that reverse heart disease. And I'm also real curious about the olive oil versus, you know, what I teach people, which is to that oils are a highly processed, artificial, calorically dense food. But so for the vegans who are listening, who are not going to eat fish at all, do you have thoughts or recommendations? Is there enough evidence to say that pescatarian is clearly superior to full-on vegan, or are there other things they should do to make up for the salmon deficiency or the sardine deficiency in their diets as you see it?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously you can be vegan and you can be very healthy. As a whole, vegans are not necessarily doing that well compared to people that eat otherwise, right? And that's surprising, right? Because that you will expect the vegans to do much better. So the suspicion is that that you go from one problem to another, right? So, for example, many vegans that I talk to, I ask them, what did you eat in the last 24 hours? And I mean, keep in mind that I'm vegan beside 2 meals a week, right? So you're talking to somebody that's very close to a vegan. But, you know, if I ask the question, in most of the times, they'll be protein deficient, right? It doesn't mean all vegans are protein deficient, but lots of them are. And, because they don't realize that you need half a kilogram, you need a pound of garbanzo beans to have enough proteins, even if you only weigh 150 pounds. And I have that, many times a week, but most of the vegans I talk to don't.
Right, so you're talking about sort of vegan versus a whole food plant-based, right? So vegans can eat, you know, just pasta and junk and it's simple, right? As opposed to someone who is getting all of their calories from whole plant foods.
Yeah, I mean, of course, now I'm talking about vegan. Yeah, they can eat whatever they want as long as it's plant-based, right? And now, you know, if you get into the more careful categories, we don't know because there's just not enough people that do that to have, you know, epidemiological data. But for sure, you're starting to get into if you're talking about the masses, you're starting to get into a difficult situation, meaning that if you eliminate fish and then you start eliminating, let's say, also the pasta and the bread and the rice or certainly have low levels, then you're going to have a very little portion of the population being able to carry it out. Now, and also you're entering an area that is poorly understood. You know, so what happens? So we know that a high carbohydrate diet over and over and over is the most beneficial one, right? I mean, the ones that comes up on top. So if you eliminate starches, now all of a sudden it becomes extremely difficult to have enough calories to get to the end of the day, right? And now you're even saying, let's eliminate oils. Then it becomes impossible to get to the end of the day, right? And I mean, few people, but like 1 in 100 can do that. Most people are just going to struggle, you know, and we see this all the time, right? So this is why Esselstyn and Ornish, really the data doesn't support low nuts and low olive oil. Now, there could be some olive oils that contribute to inflammation, but overall, the data is very positive. And I just, I mean, unless somebody is in a very advanced state of heart problems, I just don't see, the overwhelming majority of the results are positive in favor of the good fats. I love to look at the ones that are negative, but if you look at the Esselstyn data, I mean, it's very few patients that have actually been published on. I don't think it's been ever even randomized versus the Estruc data, which is thousands of patients randomized. I think we have to go with the pillars and with the data. And I mean, if Esselstyn and Ornish want to come up with data that shows why that's not true, that absolutely. But even if you look at the recent data on mice that had a higher, even higher fat content, they live longer. So it's high fat, low protein. They live longer than mice put on a low fat diet, the typical low fat diet. So again, multiple pillars are suggesting that the good fats are, in their case, they're even arguing the bad fats. But I would, I don't go in that direction because, the bad fats seem to kill mice early. So I always thought that that's probably not a good idea. But the healthy fats, salmon, nuts, and olive oil, are pretty consistently come up on the right side of things. And if you look at the Mediterranean diet, the meta-analysis are showing reduction of diseases. Not huge effects, but certainly better than the other diets, right? So now, how would they perform if somebody had a plant-based diet, low fat, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, I don't know. Nobody knows. But certainly, it is a very very tricky territory because nobody knows, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. So the kind of study that you'd like to see would be, say, a randomized trial with some Esselstyn and Ornish versus a higher fat olive oil diet with fish.
Well,
over
no, for the yeah. Yeah, for the regular population, no, I don't even want to see that because nobody can do that diet, right? Very few people can do that diet. I mean, the reality is when you spend time like I do with thousands and thousands of people, you know, 1 in 100 can do it. So, I mean, I'm all for it. If you have, you know, an advanced cardiovascular disease state like the ones that the assistant has been describing, it can work for you, sure. You know, do it. I mean, obviously, if you can do it, do it. But when you're talking to the masses, that's, you know, that's an impossible diet to have. You know, I would never do it, and most people that I know would never do it. And so you have to look at, you have to do a little compromise. Well, first of all, you know, yeah, it'd be nice to show it at least in a randomized study for the people that are in an advanced stage. You know, so let's take, you know, 500, 600 patients, randomize them, and then give them, you know, the Essestin and Ornish diet, and then randomize it to the same with good fats, right? That's never been done. Let's see that, the trial. I mean, everybody that has ever looked at data will say they're going to do as well. But, you know, let's see. Maybe they do worse, but we need to see it. And but that, I think, will still have to be confined to people that have a real problem, and they may adopt this very severe Essestin diet because of where they are. When you're talking about the general population, I think it's one of those directions that are not going to really help, because it's so extreme that the great majority of people won't do it.
See, now, you have to come if over. Somebody, if you're ever in North Carolina, come over to my house, and I'll try to change your mind with a meal.
No, I know. But, I mean, you know, don't forget that I was in Walford's lab, right? So Walford was on a crazy diet.
Right, but I mean,
and
you
could do it, and there's a couple thousand people around the United States that could do it, you know, but they're called cronies. You know, in the long run, they ended up doing worse than they thought, you know, and same thing for the monkey. So I'm just saying something that looks very positive in the short run doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be very positive in the long run, especially when you get into these phases of life like, you know, over 65, where you start having immunosenescence, the immune system starts changing, et cetera, et cetera. And there's also inflammatory problems, like a lot of vegetables, whole grains and vegetables can have strong pro-inflammatory effects. And so now when you push somebody particularly on a diet that is very heavy on something they never had before, you can start seeing all kinds of problems that you know, and this is person specific, right? Some people may do very well, but then some people may do very poorly on having whole grains, for example, right? So that's where the complexity starts, and I think that we need to keep that in mind. And I'm not saying it cannot work. I'm just saying it's trickier than we think. You know?
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Well, I really appreciate your insights and this book. And so for my vegan friends who are getting a little excited, remember that we're talking about a like 95% vegan diet, maybe fish twice a week, and not, you know, not huge portions either.
And it's not necessary, you know, it's not necessary. I mean, they can stay vegan. I'm just saying that they have to match those two fish meals with you know, vegan nutrition. So it's not necessary to introduce animals. There could be ethical reasons for not doing it, and that's perfectly fine. I'm just saying, be careful at not paying attention and being vegan, because it can easily get into the malnourishment area.
Right, and what I'm saying is just in terms of your influence on the world, you know, in a world where a lot of the science and scientists are embracing ketogenic, very high protein diets. You know, you're not coming out of the plant-based or vegan camp, and you are basically advocating a largely whole food plant-based diet with a couple of exceptions for fish and olive oil. That, you know, if the world adopts the way you eat, we'll all be a lot better off.
Yeah, I think so. And now, why is olive oil not part of the vegan diet?
Well, because I'm
that part that.
Well, because you know, it's.
I mean, just in terms of in tune with evolution, it's extremely processed food that we probably have only had for, you know, since we invented the press. And
oh, you mean in that sense? Not absolutely. And this is why I think if you did not have the Italians, the Greeks, the Loma Linda people, and the clinical data and all of that showing lots of nuts and lots of olive oil are actually associated with longer lifespan, I would also eliminate it. But, you know, because people love it, because it gives you calories that you need, because it does push you a little bit in the ketogenic mode, and because of this data, you have to go with the facts and say, look, it's probably a good way to go, you know, because you got to eat something, and that's the other thing, you know, you can't. It's difficult to have too many rules, you know, for most people. You know.
Right. Although I would say that, you know, the blue zone countries can get away with more olive oil because they are so much more active. Right. They're you know, walking and fishing and gardening and you know, I think there has to be a match to your movement and the amount and the richness of your diet, no?
You know, if most data would suggest that the higher fat, and this is not just the good fat, even the bad fat, you know, this is why the Atkins diet is so popular. So most data would suggest that you're going to lose weight and not gain weight by having a high olive oil and not diet. There's very little data going against this. So the caloric input is there, obviously, but it does not, particularly the good fats. I mean, there's almost very little data suggesting that. I mean, the weight gain in most countries, like southern Italy, is definitely not due to olive oil. It's due to the high starch diet. And, you know, and of course, sweets and other things that they eat, you know. So there is very, very little data suggesting that, especially the good fats. But even the bad fats are contributing. In fact, almost every paper, I mean, I'm very much against the Atkins diet, but almost every paper is showing weight loss. I mean, with a high bad fat, high protein diet, it's showing weight loss. And I'm always tell people, look, you know, this is an illusion because eventually it's going to hurt you. But just from the point of view of weight gain or loss, if you have a high fat diet, in most of the studies will show weight loss.
Gotcha. One last question. I told them I was interviewing you, and they wanted to know, is there a difference in the results of the fasting mimicking diet and the longevity diet for men versus women, and, you know, premenopausal or postmenopausal women?
Well, no difference in men and women. We saw similar results in men and women. Pretty soon now we're trying to get the data for, you know, over 30,000 people. I mean, I don't know how many we're going to get, but certainly over 30,000 people have done it. We try to hopefully get a couple thousand feedbacks. And premenopausal and postmenopausal, we did not have that many women that were postmenopausal. You know, at some point, I think that's something that we're going to look into, but yeah, we haven't done that yet.
Gotcha. And finally, for people who want to try the fasting mimicking diet through the product that you've scientifically validated and who want to follow your work, where should they go?
Yeah, they go to there's a website called Prolon FMD, Prolon FMD, fasting mimicking diet.com, I think, and then they take it from there, and there's a questionnaire and some other qualification questions, and then they can either they're either assigned to somebody that needs a doctor or somebody that can do it just by talking to a registered dietitian that I think the company provides. So
gotcha. And are you active, like, on a website or blog or social media?
Yes, I have a first of all, I have a foundation called the Create Cures Foundation, and all the proceeds of my book go to the Create Cures Foundation. And and it's createcures.org. And then I have a Facebook page where we post articles of studies that we think are well done and interesting to people. Lots of vegan studies. And that's a PROF, Professor Walter Longo, Facebook page. So PROF Walter Longo Facebook page. And if they like the page, then they just get the articles as we identify them. Now, I think soon enough, we're also going to start having some PhDs, selecting some PhDs to start writing articles, because lots of times the journalist may not completely get the point of papers. So I thought it was, for some things that I really care about, like proteins and you know, these, like say, good vegetables and pro-inflammatory vegetables, we're going to have a number of topics that I really love that I think it'd be good to have a PhD that spends some time figuring out what's real and what's not.
That's a great service to eliminate the middleman of the science journalist, most of whom I find don't really understand what they're reading.
Yeah, and no, the problem is most of them are not, they don't come from the medical or science background, and it's very hard for a journalist like that. It's impossible to put in the context, right? To say, okay, this group has discovered this, but let's look at 50 papers, right? What did they show? You know, what is consistent? What are the pillars showing? And that's what I thought, that, you know, I don't want to blame them because, you know, lots of them are doing a great job, but it's just impossible to really explain it in a way that can be useful to a reader. Say, well, what should I do now? You know, if you, let's say, you know, when there's a paper that came out recently showing tomatoes are bad for you, and in the same paper it had tomatoes are bad for you, and then pizza is good for you. It's epidemiological data, right? So I was laughing because, like, you know, somebody reading this, they're gonna say, what? What is this? What does it mean? You know? And so, well, you know, it, because they were talking about pro-inflammatory and the effect of pro-inflammatory vegetables and meats, etc., on colon cancer. And the paper was probably very interesting, but it really needed somebody to say, okay, let's look at the reality. For most people, tomatoes are fine. For a few people, tomatoes might be bad. Same thing for you know, gluten. And those are some of the examples where I think that I just, you know, I feel really bad because I'm thinking if I was just an average reader, I would be very confused. Now I see all this data attacking vegetables. You know?
Right, and that's just, you know, people who are acting out of goodwill. We're not even talking about all the industry marketing that's deliberately trying to muddy the water for us.
You know, these were a top journal, top research group, and probably, you know, the data, and now, of course, we're also very interested in trying to break it apart because it had red meat and tomatoes in the same group, right? So, of course, I started thinking, well, wait a minute, you know, which one is contributing what? Is maybe the tomatoes are contributing to a 0.3% increase in inflammation, and the meat is contributing to 80%, and then they average out to 37, I think it was. So you know, it's very complex, and probably there was nothing wrong with that study, but there was probably something wrong with the way then, you know, it gets in the news, it gets presented, and then it gets used to argue, oh, you see, vegetables are bad for you.
Right. Well, so I'll include a link to the Facebook page and to the Prolon FMD and to createcures.org in the show notes for today's episode. And again, I really want to thank you. The work you're doing is phenomenal. I'm going to be bragging when you will win the Nobel Prize that I got to on an interview. And just, you know, thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Very, very nice interview.
Well, I hope you found that really valuable, really useful. And it seems like this would be a good episode to share with people in your life who are not plant-based, who might be ketogenic or low carb. I think Walter Longo has a ton of credibility, and he might be able to get through to people that the rest of us can't. So if you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the mission of the Plant Yourself podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. And if you go to plantyourself.com and you look on the right sidebar for the Patreon link, you can click through to there and support the mission of the show financially as well. May was a milestone month. It's the first time I've ever received over $500. And to celebrate, I am in New York right now, and I'm doing this outro not on my home computer, but on a Zoom H6 portable recorder that I will be able to do a lot more in the field podcasting with, and hopefully with higher quality as well. And that was only possible, at least psychologically, because of the support I got this month from Patreon. And I would love to get that up even higher. I'd love to get to $2,500 a month. That's kind of the dream that would allow me to really give it the time it deserves and not subsidize it from all the other work that I do and have been doing. All right, so for more information about WellStart Health's Big Change program, which is coming up, we're starting on May 21st. We'd like to get everyone enrolled by May 14th so we can onboard you leisurely without having to kind of rush everything at the last minute. Go to wellstarthealth.com/program. If you want to get healthy and fit, this is the program that Josh Lajani and I developed, and it's been refined by the folks at WellStart, by Olivia Kelly and Bojana Jankovic. And it's changed so many lives. Certainly it's changed Josh's and my life, being privileged to be in a position where we get to help people, hold their hands, walk them through what has been in the past very painful failures, where people were motivated to change and maybe they even knew what to do and how to do it, but they didn't know how to sustain it. And they didn't have the mindset and the skills in the community to make it a regular part of their lives. If you go to bigchangeprogram.com, which is the website that we used to use to sell and to enroll, you can at least see the testimonials and see Josh's story and a little bit of my story. I don't even know what to say, because it's kind of awkward for me to be selling this. I believe in it so much, and I just want people to take advantage of it, to be healthy, to spread the word. I just want this message of plant-based wellness, of the possibility of us taking our health back in our own hands. I was just in Washington, D.C. at a conference, and there's a lot of enlightened people there around healthcare, around benefits, around the system, around the economics of it. And yet it was so sad to see people so in denial just of their own eating habits and exercise habits and mindset habits, that could have any impact on their wellness. And it's a message that really needs to get out there. And this is me and Josh, the way we're spreading it. So if you want to jump on board, again, wellstarthealth.com/program. If you want to check out the show notes for today's episode with Dr. Walter Longo, you can look at it at plantyourself.com/269. And if you're new to the show, you can catch up on 268 archived episodes over at plantyourself.com, where you can also get my weekly-ish, more ish than weekly these days, newsletter. In garden news, everything I'm going to report is secondhand since I've been traveling D.C. and then New York City. But my wife sent me some pictures. My wife and my son put some, I couldn't even see what it was. It was on the phone. But some plants are in the ground. And when I get home, I'll let you know what they are, and how they're doing. In running news, I have some really exciting running news, which is that I got to see the same sort of physical therapist / trainer / body whisperer who helped Josh Lajani overcome his back problems. And I've seen him twice so far in New York City, and it's amazing the work that he did on me to kind of retilt my pelvis so that I'm walking better, running better, without pain, without hip flexor soreness and tightness. I have one more session with him tomorrow, and all I can say is, like, don't live with pain if you haven't tried, everything. Like this guy, I don't want to share his name publicly because he's not interested in that kind of publicity. If you're really interested, if you really are, you know, if you're near New York and you really need help with gait, with posture, with pain, you know, hit me up via email, hj@plantyourself.com, and I can put you in touch. But it's just amazing to feel like my body is stacked one bone on top of the other the way it's supposed to, and all sorts of things are just feeling easier. So I couldn't be happier. So thanks to our mystery PT guy, and of course thanks to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use Sabali Dawn, the Dance of Peace, as this podcast's theme music. Visit willridenour.com, that's RIDENOUR.com, for more of his music. And last, thanks to all you Plant Yourself podcast patrons. Let's see if I can do this now from afar. Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Anthony Disson, Brittany Porter, Dominic Mauro, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hathaway, Mary Jane Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Burns, Christine Nielsen, Tina Scharf, Tina Ahern, Jennifer Lukanowski, David Bodvik, Mysterious Michelle X, Elizabeth Feldman, Katori Dolomanova, Leah Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Andrew, Josina, Julian Roland, Stu Dilnick, Sarah Durkas, Ronson Circus, Kelly Cameron, Wayne Peterson, Leanne Peterson, Janet Selby, Claire Adams, Tom Franzek, Jeanette Benham, Gila, Sarah David, Donahue, Blair Cyber, Dorona Vizov, Gio and Carolyn Argentati, Jody Friesner, Ruth Ann Funderburg, Misha Rosen, Michael Warbeck, the equally mysterious Tracy Z, Alicia Lemus, Rebecca Hughes, Val Linneman, Rhymes with Cinnamon, Nick Harper, Stephanie Holmes, Martha Bergner, Nicole Ramsey, Susan Allen, Molly Levine, the inscrutable Harry R., Susan Laverty, the Panda Vegan, Craig Kovic, Adam Sharp, Karen Burley, Heather Morgan, Ashley Corker, Kelly Michia, Deanne Norton, Bonnie Lynch, Plant Happy Organs, Sabine Kurtzels, Nigel Davies, Marion Blum, Teresa Coble, Shell Rootless, Julie Juan Watkins, Breed O'Connell, Brian Sheridan, Sharon Hirschman, Kate Rolls, Linda Ayat, Julie Lang, Holm, Edgar, Isa Tuzin, Wakami, Hainline, Aaron Gree, Alicia Davis, Aviva Lale, Heather O'Connor, Carolyn Jensen, Sherry Olakoski of Plant Power for Health, Karen Smith, Scott Morani, Karen and Joe Crabtree, Tanya Lewis, Kirby Burton, Teresa Carell, Kevin McCauley, Elizabeth Rothschild, Kelly Baker, Miracle Land, Jesse, Cheryl Dwyer, Jenny Hazleton, Valerie Health TA, Peter W. Evans, Colleen Harrison, Justine Divitt, Joshua Sommermeyer, for your generous support of the podcast. That's it for this week. As always, be well, my friends. Let's take this home with some gratitudes. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize. All the stuff that I do is for you, so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.